Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
Thanks for listening to Total Information AM on this Tuesday morning. I'm Megan Lynch. For the first time in more than a decade, the number of women serving in the U.S. House and Senate will decline when the new Congress is sworn in Friday. Joining me, Kelly Dittmar, Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, Camden, and Director of Research and Scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. Kelly, thank you so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
In looking at this, was this a case of fewer women running, fewer women getting elected, or both?
Yeah, a little bit of both. We did see a drop in the number of women running this cycle as compared to the last cycle in 2022. Part of that might just be explained by the fact that we saw fewer men and women running. It was a year where we didn't have as many mix-ups due to redistricting, potentially less opportunities. But it's still notable when we have a decline in women's candidacies because, especially among Republicans, there's still a small percent, really small percent of that whole candidate pool. So in any given year, you don't want to see a drop. And then in addition to that, we saw a record number of women leaving, whether they decided to retire or run for other offices. That also meant that we were starting at a deficit when we went into the election and had to make up those losses among the women who were running. So there are a number of factors why the number went down. It didn't go down by that much. But it does show that we have to do continued and targeted work to increase not only the number of women who will win, but the number of women who will run in the first place.
Put this in perspective. How many fewer? You said not that many. And then give us kind of the picture of overall representation in Congress for folks who aren't tracking that right now.
Sure. So we had 151 women serving on Election Day, and we now, with the new Congress sworn in, have 150 women. So we're down by one, a net of one. We actually had hit a record of 152 before the end of Congress, and that was due to a short stint of a woman who served just to complete a term. But all of this is right around 28%. So while women are over 50% of the population, they're 28% of Congress. So we still have a ways to go to parity. And just one other note, when we think about partisan differences, we are seeing a net gain from Election Day to the start of this Congress for Democratic women, plus three. And we're seeing a net loss, minus three, for Republican women. So the story isn't necessarily the same for women across party lines.
Let's talk about that difference based on political party. Do you have any insight into why you think that is?
Yeah, we have always seen it's a pretty consistent trend across not only years, but also levels of office, that women are better represented in the Democratic Party. In fact, they're getting close to parity in the Democratic caucus in Congress. They are actually at or above parity with men in Democratic caucuses across over half of our state legislatures. So women are just faring better in the Democratic Party. Part of that is we have women are more likely to be Democrats in the public and in elected office. But we also know that Democrats have been more willing and actually electorally motivated to engage in targeted recruitment and support of women. So training programs, PACs that support women to run, whereas Republicans have been more averse to that. They kind of have called that quote-unquote identity politics and something that they believe is contrary to a philosophy of meritocracy, the idea that we shouldn't be focused on any particular group based on demographics. So if you are not going to engage in that targeted work, it's really hard to make up for the disparities that we've seen for, you know, over a century.
So when we look at the makeup of Congress and we break that down into the power that those women might hold within their party's structure, for example, in their caucuses, in committees, what does that look like?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, if you look in the Democratic caucus, you have more women in leadership positions, and there are a greater percentage. They're over 40% of the membership of the Democratic caucus. In contrast, in the Republican Party right now, actually in the House, we will have no women committee chairs, of course, because the Republicans hold the House. They hold all the committee chairmanships, and there are no women right now who serve in those positions because they are such a small percentage of their caucus. I think it's a bit less than 20% in this Congress. And so they do hold other leadership positions like conference chair, and that's really important because it means that they get to have more of a say and influence on agendas and priorities of the caucus. But with those numbers being small and that party being in power, it does show the disparities in power for women when Republicans are in control or in the majority.
So a lot of people may be listening to this and thinking, well, why should this matter to us? Shouldn't it just be the best person gets elected regardless of gender?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the thing we come against a lot, which is the idea that gender or race shouldn't matter. But we know that it's not about counting numbers. It's about lived experiences. So unless you believe, which some people may, that lived experiences are not at all different based on your gender or based on your race and ethnicity in our country, then we should realize the value of those different lived experiences and perspectives to policymaking. And we have lots of research to show that it does make a difference. And we certainly have lots of research to show that those lived experiences are not the same. And you can look at any statistics on health, on occupation, on advancement in education to see that you're going to have different experiences and those are going to shape policy debates in different ways. So I always say it's not about counting beans, right? It's about how do we ensure that we get the best range of perspectives to get the best possible outcomes for the largest percentage of the constituencies that are to be represented in Congress or in any other elected body.
I'm speaking with Kelly Dittmar. She is Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, Camden. I'm really curious. You mentioned for the Democratic Party, the work that they've done kind of on the front end of this to try to get women into those races, into politics. Why do you think that's so different than maybe what you might see in the Republican Party?
Yeah, I think there are two big differences. One is that you know, there is a different philosophy when it comes to what I was just speaking about in terms of the value of representation. I think there is certainly more buy-in on the Democratic side of the aisle that this range of perspectives is rooted at least in part in demographic differences, right? That it is not just that this is you are a man and woman and you check a box, but that actually shapes how you experience policy outcomes in government, and therefore those perspectives should be in government. So we see that in surveys and in other evidence that those who identify as Democrats are more likely to believe that. They're also more diverse in terms of who identifies as Democrats. That then yields electoral advantage. So it's not just that Democrats are doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. They have a constituency that is demanding greater and better more diverse representation among candidates and elected leaders. So they have an electoral incentive as well as a broader policy and sort of imperative about greater representation. That's less true on the Republican side of the aisle because, again, there's more of this perception, as you noted, of a meritocracy that is blind to demographics. And the makeup of the Republican Party is still dominantly white and dominantly male. And so they have less of an electoral pressure to put more diverse candidates on ballots and in office.
As we look to this next Congress, who are some women that you are watching?
You know, there are so many great women that already serve, and then some of the new elected women that I lift up, you know, Sarah McBride, who's the first openly trans woman in Congress, who before day one has already been combating some of the bias of being that first. I think the way that she's handled it is really notable and important, and she'll inspire others to do the same across levels of office. So I'd be watching her trajectory. There are currently now two black women in the Senate, Angela Alsobrooks and Lisa Blunt Rochester. It's the first time we've ever had two black women serving simultaneously in the Senate. That should be both surprising, but also notable in thinking about the ways in which they'll represent their constituencies and communities. And then, on the Republican side of the aisle, I would look to the women who are trying to kind of accede into more leadership and influential positions, say, of somebody like Lisa McClain from Michigan. And then also outside of Congress, somebody like Elise Stefanik, who's likely to go into the administration but was coming from or will be coming from Congress, and see the types of influence she may be able to have on policy outcomes and priorities.
Kelly, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
That, again, is Kelly Dittmar, Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, joining us on KMOX.